Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy. My guest today is a titan of stage and screen. He's most well known for his performance as a world-weary homicide detective on the HBO drama The Wire.
You know the goddamn G.O. It's homicide's call. You don't go putting your paws in my
murder. Take it easy, Bob. Al Herc is trying to help us here.
Man, he messed in my murder. He pays.
Well, give him a chance. We can work something out.
It's easy for you to say. You ain't the primary on this.
And he walked the now Duchess of Sussex Meghan Markle down the aisle as our on-screen dad in the legal drama Suits.
About your daughter's home. Don't you dare use my daughter as a bargaining chip. She's a grown-ass woman. She can take care of herself. So, like Harvey said, you take care of your house, because I'm going to take care of mine.
He's also a Tony Award-winning producer for Cliburn Park and has written an award-winning memoir, The Wind in the Reeds, about rebuilding his family life and community after Hurricane Katrina devastated his home city of New Orleans. Wendell Pierce starred as the tragic anti-hero in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman at the Young Vic Theatre. London's first Black Lohman family and its success is reflected in the fact that it's transferring to the West End in October. So this week we're asking, should race matter on stage? I caught up with Wendell Pierce backstage at the theatre before a performance in early July. Wendell Pierce, welcome to The Economist Asks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Remaking Arthur Miller, that iconic play with a mainly black cast, replacing the Jewish Willie Lohman with an African-American. How much do you associate with that particular incarnation?
One, I just want to correct you. It's not a remake at all. We are doing the play. And Willie Lohman is Willie Lohman. Mr. Miller never said he was Jewish. It has become an assumption, a cultural assumption, as it has been presented over these 70 years, that the family is Jewish because Mr. Miller was Jewish. Everyone is aware of that he based this on his uncle Marty, and all artists kind of start from who they are and where they are. But actually, race is not very much a part of the play at all. Secondly, we service all the conflict, all of the principles, all of the ideas and conceits that Mr. Miller wanted his audience to consider over the course of the play. To add the interpretation of an African-American family is to add illumination to that. I don't believe any interpretation should be done if it's just trite or a gimmick. It should be done only if it illuminates. And the more specific you are, the more universal it becomes. So all of the different obstacles that were placed in front of Willie Lohman, all of the confrontations that he has, adding the element of being an African-American man, adds just another variable to it and illuminates the play even more. That's why I wanted to do it. That's why I feel as though it works, and why I believe that the Miller estate approached our director, Marianne Elliott, and asked her to do it.
When you were approached to do it, how surprised were you that it was going to become really an overwhelmingly black cast? Another way you could have done it is you could have taken the role, but the family could have been whichever race. They could have been white, they could have been a mixture of races. That would have been another way to do it.
Right, which has been done before. There was a production just last year where it was colorblind casting. I don't believe in colorblind casting in particular works, in this one in particular, not to cast any dispersion on the other production or any other productions that have done it. It is so rooted in a specific time that I think it loses something if it's just colorblind casting, because there's the specificity that you need about the family. Colorblind casting suggests that we're going to pretend that race doesn't matter, and we all know that the ugly side of humanity is that race is a consideration at all times. That's personally what I believe. It would be naive to believe that race isn't a part of an interpretation when naturalism or this sort of investigation of a specific time happens. When it comes to opera or verse, you know, or Shakespeare or whatever, I'm the opposite, you know. People always say, well, you know, you couldn't have that white daughter, Wendell, because, you know, you're a black man. I'm like, well, we don't speak in iambic pentameter either. So if we're going to use the barometer of naturalism to decide whether or not this interpretation happens, we shouldn't do Shakespeare at all because people don't do it. We shouldn't do opera at all because people don't come with a libretto and this wonderfully orchestrated music beneath them as they speak, and they happen to know it, all the notes at the same time.
Last thought on the play, because I'd love it if you'd tell me whether I was seeing this as you felt that you were acting it. I thought for a long time, is this race just going to kind of hover around it? Any questions about race or its impact? And I thought this is worn very lightly. And it's then when we get to, there are a couple of points. I think there's a restaurant scene, and there's also that sense of once we see him having to sort of base himself before someone else who's treating Willie Loman very badly, his boss, who just seems to think he's some sort of human algorithm to provide work. And at that point, I felt it. And I wondered, did we as the audience feel those references in the same places that you and the cast did? Or did we
absolutely
perhaps miss up?
No, absolutely. And actually, the audiences have illuminated some even more. When you speak of the restaurant scene, before our interpretation, it is always seen as the Loman boys are given a special place, your own private room, your own private dining room. And just the suggestion of a white waiter telling these young men, no, back here you feel a lot more comfortable. You're seeing it through our eyes and our experience that a lot of times, because, you know, you are an African-American patron, you go to restaurants and you are treated poorly. And without changing a line, the audiences, and we hadn't even considered it in rehearsal, that the audience came to me. People would come to me afterwards and say, man, and when they put them in the back and segregated them from the restaurant, it was, God, that was really hurtful. I fought for this interpretation when we were deciding on the racial makeup of the cast around me, because there was a consideration that Charlie and Bernard would be black, and that the woman I have an affair with is white, was considered to be black. But then it loses the danger of that, and I reminded that the interpretation is stronger, the danger of what happened in America and still happens in America to this day, the accusation of sexual assault or rape of a black man by a white woman. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921, Black Wall Street, the thriving neighborhood of Greenwood, Tulsa. 300 people were murdered, and the community was burned down, all because a white woman on the elevator, who a black man stumbled into, accused him of doing something indecent. And that was the response. Emmett Till whistles at a white woman in Mississippi in 1955, just 4 years, 5 years after this play, and he is brutally lynched. The entire town of Rosewood, Florida, was destroyed because of the accusation. So the idea of me having that betrayal of the family, but also now I've put Biff in jeopardy, his life in jeopardy, is endangered. It's not just a betrayal. I have actually endangered the life of my family and myself.
And because it also explains his absolute panic, yes, doesn't it, when his son turns up, which is, of course,
yes,
difficult. But you always do kind of think, why does he is really almost in a, you know, in a rictus of panic. And right. I think that's a very good example.
So it adds to it, because this woman could literally just walk out the door and both of our lives would be in danger.
Tell me a bit more about your own background. You did write a memoir, The Wind in the Reeds, describing yourself as a man of the South and your family's story.
Yeah, I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is the deep South, but it's really different. New Orleans is, I kind of say, it's the northernmost Caribbean city. It's the last Bohemia, the city that cared for God because nobody cares. There's a bon vivant nature about the city. An amalgam of different ideas and people came together to make this gumbo of a city, and that's the way we approach life. At the same time, it was a very segregated city. The ugliness of America's original sin still can be seen. But also, I grew up in a city of so much culture, the jazz and cuisine and architecture. It's a very much a part of our life. Every boy has picked up a trumpet in New Orleans at one point in their life, me included. I played trumpet for about 2 weeks. So it's a city of great culture that literally comes out of the ugliness, too. You know, when you see a jazz parade, it's an extension of Associated and Pleasure Clubs. And Associated and Pleasure Clubs came out of the fact that Black neighborhoods were redlined. We couldn't get insurance. We couldn't get into hospitals. We couldn't get burial plots. So we pooled our money in these organizations called Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs. You understand the pleasure part. You see it every day. The music, the dancing, the umbrellas, the handkerchief, the second line parade. Well, really, that was just one part of it. The other part is the social aid. So if your mother takes sick, we'll take some of the money out of pool. We've pooled together to help you. If your father dies, we're going to send him off nice, and hence the world has become aware of our jazz funerals, and that's where it came from. But once a year, these social aid and pleasure clubs also have just a second line parade for commerce, to walk commerce into the neighborhood. So it literally is a moving economic engine, you know, on Sundays. So it really, my memoir was, as we were destroyed by Hurricane Katrina, I wanted to remind myself, along with the reader, with how much our culture came from resistance and resilience to make it back, and how we were going to rebuild our city block by block, street by street.
Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath, obviously a huge impact for you personally, as mm-hmm. the man of the South and the person with this huge affinity that you've evoked for the community and for the city. What was your response to it then? What's your response to it now? And have the intervening years changed anything about the way that you look at this catastrophe, actually largely a man-made catastrophe?
Yes, it is a man-made catastrophe. We have to be vigilant about those who actually were never held accountable. But it taught me that if you have to exercise the right of self-determination, that and in the most vulnerable times, a community can be destroyed and let go, forever forgotten about. And no one will ever take the time to say, you are worthy of rebuilding, unless you make that demand of those people in government, those people, just whoever is a part of the rebuilding, that you have to exercise your right of self-determination, make sure that people know that you are valued, that your community is valued, and in their planning, that they plan to bring you back. Because what happened in New Orleans was they thought it was an ideal opportunity to do a land grab, get rid of as many people as possible, and then, say, after the course of a specific time, just reappropriate the property. And I knew that was going to happen. And that has happened to a certain extent and was planned to happen. And they put it on the front page of our newspaper. Put green dots over all the neighborhoods. They just were going to say, we're going to let go back to green space. And I was like, they're not going to let it go back to green space. This is one of the great ports of the world. So they're not just going to let it go. They're just going to try to encourage all of these people to give up their properties and leave. And I pointed that, and I organized my community to make sure that they knew they had to advocate against that, you know, hard and strong. That's when we put together the Puncture Train Park Community Development Corporation, negotiated all the properties that people gave up and said, we're not coming back, to give them to us so we can redevelop them. To date, we built 40 properties. So another company has taken over the remainder properties. We have about 100 more that they're going to develop.
But you still spend a lot of time there. Is that where you live?
Yeah, I'm tri-coastal. So I live in Los Angeles, and I live in New Orleans, and I live in New York.
The Wire is probably the series many viewers in Britain will know you from. Of course, many in the US, many more in the US for five series from 2002. Mm-hmm. You played Bunk Morland, our hard-drinking cigar chomping detective. You have said that it was a deep and a rich experience playing this character, The Wire. You know, people sit and have arguments about whether The Wire or The Sopranos is the greatest TV series ever made. What was it about The Wire, and please reference your own character and your input into that, that has us still having that conversation long after we've enjoyed and forgotten quite a lot of
I think
dramas?
Well, what happened was The Wire was a visual novel, and when the great things about David Simon was the fact that he convinced the network and convinced people on television that audiences did not have to have everything wrapped up and neatly packaged by the end of the hour. That like a good book, they're willing to go from chapter to chapter to see how characters develop, how storylines develop. And he always came to us as actors and he's to say that this is a visual novel. And up until the point of The Wire and The Sopranos coming to starting this golden age of television, which is, we are definitely in a golden age, people, you know, could tune in and out of series and come to it at any time, and it would be, you know I got the beginning, the crime happened at the beginning of the hour, and the prosecution happened at the end of the hour, done. But it didn't happen like that, and that's why The Wire was called Dickensian, and so that you had these mercurial characters like McNulty, or these, you know, gruff, salt-of-the-earth sort of homicide detectives like Bunk Morland, the character that I played, coming together in the most unlikely situations as homicide detective partners, but then finding something in each other that they really respected that held them close as friends.
And race plays a big role here, as it must in this drama set in Baltimore. I wonder if you look at that and you're looking at the way that you've reinterpreted a role with as an African American that 70 years ago you have this very successful incarnation, which is set in a, you know, those are right on the edge of society a few years ago. And we look at the argument and debate about race in America today. Do you feel you're on a good trajectory, or do you think so many of the questions are unresolved? You talked about original sin.
I think, yes, the America's original sin is just that. You know, those who understand and believe in the original sin of Adam and Eve, that we are forever chronically asking for repentance, is exactly how I see America's original sin of race, of slavery, how the country was built. My father, in five more years, we'll be 100 years old. He'll be half the age of the country, almost, you know? So it wasn't that long ago that we started this nation where you had millions of people who were being treated as chattel, who, against the law and at the risk of death, learned to read, and some of them, and read this charter from this country that said, all men are created equal and have the right to pursue life and liberty, liberty, true freedom, and the pursuit of happiness, as they were enslaved, as they were, families were separated. In my family in particular, my great-grandfather, Aristide Harris, was sold as a baby with his mother as a nigger and a half, and his earliest childhood memory is being on a barge, a riverboat, after being sold, and seeing his father and his other siblings on the banks who he never got to know. That's his first childhood memory, right? Think of the trauma of that. And at night, my great-great-grandmother would tell him, Aristide, his mother, you're not a Harris, you're a Christoph. One day, make it back to Kentucky and find your brothers and sisters and your father, if you ever get free. And to know the trauma of that. And people ask, well, why do you bring that up? That's so long ago. What the hell do you think is happening in Homestead, Florida right now? Children separated from their parents, traumatically sleeping on the floors in prison who have done nothing wrong. Nothing. Nothing. And if you think walking into a country without the proper documentation is worthy of imprisonment, of separation of families, of creating concentration camps, it's an ugly part of human nature. It's an ugly part of human nature that we have to be ever vigilant about, because this is how the worst in humanity can, when merged with power and control, turn out to be some of the most violent and dangerous times.
And does that give you, you've been very, you know, politically vociferous at times, does that give you pause for thought, as we had an African-American president, two terms, then the big switch to Donald Trump? Does it make you think, well, some gains were maybe less secure than was thought? Did you always doubt that they were secure?
I always told my liberal friends, you know, this is not, it's an ongoing thing, it's a continuum. It is a pendulum that swings back and forth. The barbarians are always at the gate. The only benefit of Donald Trump is the fact that he is a reminder that that in America, racism thrives, fascism thrives, sexism thrives, that this entire immigration charade, or as you said here, charade, is completely an exercise in militarized racism. I studied, and I do Jack Ryan, which is a show on Amazon, shameless plug. I play a CIA officer. And so we were researching at the CIA, January 6th, I'll never forget the date, 2017. Trump had just been elected. He was awaiting his inauguration. And that weekend, the neo-Nazis rented the Ronald Reagan building, a building that my parents, my grandparents, that I paid for with my tax dollars, right? Two blocks from the White House, three blocks from the Holocaust Museum, and were in celebration of Donald Trump coming into office, going, see Kyle, running up and down the aisles, throwing up the salute. January 6th, 2017. And so that was a reminder to me that Nazis are still alive, Nazism is still alive, racism is still alive, and slavery is still happening in this world. All of the ugliest things that we think are gone, I think it's naive and it's offensive to me when the liberal view is, oh, but you know, I thought we made all of these strides with Obama. We did. But you have to understand that that fight goes on past
Obama. And can I just jump in there and ask you, no, it's fascinating to follow that line. And let's look into just briefly into the Democratic nomination, the contest. Do you, it's a personal question about your preferences, so you don't mind, but do you vote at all on lines of affinity? Would you support an African-American candidate
openly,
over a white one?
I open. It's never a choice of race. It's a choice of what's right. Someone I know personally is Kamala Harris, so I support her in her effort, and I'm still open. So I support all of them. Because they're all trying to actually save the country from Trump, because Trump is destroying democratic institutions and the rule of law, and he's a Nazi, and he's a fascist.
Donald Trump is that? I mean, for absolutely. That's a very bold claim to call Donald Trump a Nazi. I mean, some people, I mean, perhaps even I find that perhaps a line not to be crossed, because what do you then say when you do encounter a real Nazi or someone who is, as we now say, a neo-Nazi? Really, are you sure that that is an okay description?
The neo-Nazis celebrated.
Yes, but that is not the same as Trump being a
and
Nazi.
And Donald Trump said there were good people. I'm taking the words out of his mouth. They were good people. And the thing about fascists and Nazis today is they disguise it in sort of ambiguous language so they can make sure that when someone like myself call them out for what they are, they can say, I'm not a Nazi. I'm alt-right. I'm not a Nazi. I'm the new whatever acronym that they've come up with. And racists and fascists have done that over the course of time. I remember I actually reminded my cast of this. When I was a little boy, the one thing my parents always schooled me about, don't let them do this to you. It was always a thing in New Orleans and in the South. You rub a little nigger's head for luck. So a white man would come up, oh, you did a good job, kid, and rub my head. I said, don't do that, man. And if you called him on it, I know what you're doing. What? I'm just being effusive and happy for
there
you.
Is, so, I do feel I should, but there is a counter-argument, which is, and we need to stick on this for the rest of our adult lives, which is, is that you end up with a lack of differentiation on the centre-left, and particularly as you go to the left, that almost anything that is an ultra-populism that offends the values you hold dear, rightly, then ends up with being described using a language of an extreme ideology. And it might sort of blur.
But what I'm saying is that there was no blurring here. Neo-Nazis believe in hatred of Jews, of people of color, of anyone who wasn't
Aryan.
Well,
I'm sure, you know, Donald Trump would incredibly deny that he hates Jews, wouldn't he?
Then why did he say there were good people in that? What was the chant that night in Charlottesville? What was the chant? And then one of the members of that camp went out and ran over an auntie who was protesting against them. And Donald Trump then said, hey, listen, there were good people on both sides. When he goes out of his way to say, my favorite president, out of all the presidents, indistinguishably chooses Andrew Jackson, who said, we can get rid of the Native American. We will attempt to get rid of the Native American. We will put them in concentration camps. We will make them walk across the country to concentration camps. Once infected with smallpox, we will not cure them. Andrew Jackson is on record as being the equivalent of what Nazis believe.
And you think Donald Trump is signaling something?
He's not signaling, he says it. Andrew Jackson's my favorite president. Had a rally at his house. Put the bust of Andrew Jackson behind his desk. So every time you see a picture of him there, he has a bust of Andrew Jackson, who believed in the same things that Nazis believed in. And people say that, oh, that's a line to be crossed, but isn't he crossed the line. And when he crosses the line, he has no accountability. And people say, well, we shouldn't call him a Nazi, when he is.
If Donald Trump wanted to come and see your Death of a Salesman or see something else you were in, what would your response be to that?
I would let him come and make sure he pays for his ticket.
So you wouldn't feel as Mike Pence, when he went to Hamilton, some of the audience booed him, which clearly sent the signal they didn't think he should have been in the theatre.
No, it sent a signal that they didn't like his politics. That they didn't like his politics. It didn't say that he wasn't supposed to be in the audience. It was like, we don't like your politics, you know. And actually, the cast wanted to speak to him, and actually, at the curtain call, read a letter to him, so that we hope that you understand what this play is about. That is open, because even before they got in office, they had already declared that we are going to come down on immigrants, right? That our immigration policy will be racist. Basically, because if they're not closing, you know, they're not exacting their policies even across the board. But so they just expressed, the audience members were expressing their dislike of them. They weren't saying that he was being denied from the audience. If Trump came, I would hope he paid for his ticket, and I wouldn't want to meet him.
I can't finish without asking you about your famous on-screen family in Suits, which I've watched on many a flight. I think it's got me across the Atlantic any number of times. I'm now such an expert on the American legal system, you wouldn't believe it. And you play Robert Zane, Rachel Zane's father. Rachel Zane, of course, was played by Meghan Markle, now the Duchess of Sussex, and also a guest on this show previously. How did you find working with her?
She's a sweetheart, and she's a very talented actress. I loved working with her. One of the things I think is a regret is that she won't be acting anymore. I'm trying to encourage, this has been my mantra in all interviews going around, that that hopefully that, you know, maybe she and her husband, the prince, will do the A.R. Gurney play, Love Letters, which would be really lovely just for them to be able to do this play where they exchange love letters between the two writers.
Do you think she'll miss her acting career?
I think she will. Maybe not all the time. Maybe not all the time.
Wendell Pierce, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we want to hear what you think about race, politics, and theatre. Write to us, radio@economist.com, or you can tweet us at Economist Radio. You can subscribe at economist.com/radio offer. 12 issues for £12 or $12. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.